Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am your host, Jason Verlinde. You all owe me. I just recorded an intro to this very episode of the podcast. I thought it was great, and then I listened back to it. It was 10 minutes long. I'm going to spare you all that. I'm just going to blaze through this revised introduction. Today's guest is Cameron Noller, the Fretboard Journal's newest contributor, one of my favorite people. I just met him. He's already written a great profile of Harrison Whitford for us in our 52nd issue, which is mailing out next week. He is a thinking man's guitarist, as you are about to hear, and his life story is like none other I have ever heard. He just put out a book called Guitars Have Feelings Too. It rocked my world. We talk a lot about it. It is all about backup flat picking guitar from the style of Norman Blake going backwards. There's tab in it. You can just read this and learn a ton about the evolution of old time and bluegrass music. I'm making this sound academic, but it's truly a great book with lots of little bite-sized nuggets of wisdom that you can use in your playing. I cannot recommend it enough. Cameron is going to be at the Fretboard Summit in August. I hope to see some of you there. It's going to be the greatest guitar party ever. You should come if you're thinking about it. Book your tickets now. They're going to sell out. As always, we have some sponsors for this podcast. Deering Banjos, thank you. Our friends at Peghead Nation, our friends at Isotope, and our friends at Stringjoy Strings are all offering you discount codes. Check out the show notes of this episode, and you will learn how to save money on all of those great products that I stand by. And this has been my shortest intro to date to compensate for the long one that I already recorded. Thank you for tuning in. If you love the show, leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts. And here is my interview with Cameron Noller. I'm going to include a link to his new book in the show notes because I thoroughly recommend it, and I think a lot of you would benefit from it. I know I learned a ton. Cameron, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't remember exactly how our paths crossed. I think maybe through Jack Snyder or maybe through Bob Minner, but at some point in the last year or two, you and I started talking. I've seen your byline in acoustic guitar. I've heard about you forever, and I've just been in awe of your contributions and our back and forth and our texts and everything. So I'm really happy to finally share your story.
Likewise. Thank you. Excited to be here and very glad our paths crossed when they did. I remember getting a subscription to Fretboard Journal when I was, 15 or 16, and I've followed it ever since. So it's an honor. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, let's start there. You have a book and an album coming out that we're going to get into, but like, where did you grow up? I think I read Arizona.
Yeah, I grew up originally in Yuma, Arizona, which it's a funny place because every person that I speak to who's from Arizona or who has spent a significant time in Arizona, they always have something funny to say about it. It's a historically pretty dense area, but it's also visually an interesting place too. But yeah, it's basically on the California border. And then moved to Texas when I was 13. And then that's kind of where I came of age musically. It was in Texas.
Okay. And in Texas, you've got this whole book. We talk a lot about bluegrass, but I know your skills, you know, cross all genres. Like, what music were you playing when you took up guitar?
I basically, in Arizona, I had a really great teacher who still teaches guitar, Aaron Holtstrand. The first thing I learned was the like King of the Hill theme song, you know, like, and so going back and listening to King of the Hill, though I wasn't in that vein of music, they were between the transitions of scenes. There's like dobro and Mark Knopfler-esque kind of like bridge pickup strat licks, which I just wanted to learn the intro, which was acoustic guitar, but I wasn't playing acoustic guitar. I was playing like hair metal riffs and stuff. And so that kind of was pushed off to the side. It was almost like a teenage kind of, it was something that I was just, I feel like dexterity was something that came easily. So I was like, okay, I could play these riffs, but there was nothing musical about them. And then I pushed the guitar off to the side. And when I first heard Norman Blake, I was on a trip in the American West, and there was a family bluegrass band who played Whiskey Before Breakfast. Used YouTube when I got home, and the first thing that came up was Norman on his first homespun tape, and that kind of just pushed me down this singular path that I had never experienced before. There wasn't something that opened up and, you know, said, this is what you need to pursue, and you need to sound as close to this as possible. Or not sound as close, but basically trying to get close to the fluidity of his right hand. I feel like that was really the first beacon that spoke to me. And so, yeah, I just kind of did anything, burned all bridges to be able to do that, and ended up going to music school in Texas. And, you know,
did I read that on your website that you didn't go to school?
Yeah, no, that's not a joke. So it's funny. I mean, yeah. So there's homeschooling.
Yes.
And then there's a term called unschooling, which it's so funny. I hear it floating in and out of my life with people that I interface with, and everyone has a different definition of it. And it's funny, a lot of people who are now professional musicians were quote unquote unschooled, which was the name my mom put to it. And so funny enough, you know, growing up in Arizona, I was super isolated. So, I didn't really meet someone my own age except for my brother until I was like 10 or 11, basically, because it was like a snowbird community. So yeah, I didn't have a high school diploma. And when I was 15, I just applied at the community college, and I did my my associate's degree. And then when I went to music school, I didn't know what music school was. I Googled, how do you study music in Houston, Texas in college? And I got connected with this great guitar player, Mike Wheeler, who played with Willie Nelson a lot, and Bucky Meadows, some Texas, a lot of Texas legends. And he kind of had a sympathy for Norman Blake and Tony Rice. And then he was like, well, musical language is musical language. You already know how this eighth note driven flat picking music works, but you're going to need to study bebop. So then he kind of led me down the bebop path in school. But yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I was going to ask, because then you went and got a jazz degree. So unschooling, did your mom or parents have a game plan of like, you're going to read up on history, or was it really loose?
Well, I don't mean this to like throw them under the bus, because in a lot of ways I'm thankful, but I really didn't. There was not a game plan. Basically, there was not a game plan. Basically, I did go to public school. So if you imagine this person unschooled, going through that path, and then sixth grade comes around, you go to public school, and then seventh grade, you go to public school. So I did sixth and seventh grade in public school.
Okay.
Enjoyed it. And then was back on the unschooling thing until community college when I was in my teens, late teens. Wow.
Okay.
Can't make it up. Yeah. Yeah.
And your brother turned out okay too?
Yeah. Yeah. He's great. He's on, he's doing a, well, he finished up a Fulbright, in Europe, and, is now teaching overseas. So yeah, he's fine too. Not to say that I'm fine, but yeah, he's fine.
So Norman Blake hits you, you're on this family trip, you hear Whiskey Before Breakfast, and then you go down the YouTube rabbit hole, and then you find yourself going to college for jazz. Like, were you into it?
I was. You know, I mean, it was, that's a really good question. I really liked people like, I liked people like Johnny Smith and Ed Bickert and Ted Green. And, you know, I was listening to people like Norman and Dave Rawlings, and for whatever reason in my mind, not having a huge community of people to talk to about guitar, because the music school was so, how would I say? I mean, it was just a classical heavy. I mean, there, the Moore School of Music is known for like music education and classical stuff. So there wasn't a robust community of guitar people. But in my mind, I thought to myself, well, there's something, you know, this Tony Rice, John Carlini record, the way David Rawlings plays, the way Johnny Smith plays. And so I kind of just pursued the sounds of, right, I kind of clung to people like Johnny Smith, Ed Bickert, Ted Green, who were, you know, more pointed toward making arrangements sing on the guitar. And I really think that that was my saving grace, as opposed to like playing big band music. That just didn't, I was playing a Telecaster in the big band, which is fine. And Bickert did that, but I was more kind of in allegiance to the, you know, the solo guys like Ted and Johnny Smith. But I dug it, and I'm glad I went through it, because it's eighth note driven music, and it's a way of punctuating harmony. Mm-hmm. It gives you the skills of punctuating harmony without there having to be a chord progression, which I listened back to records like Norman Blake Live at McCabe's, and that's basically what he's doing, is the Charlie Parker thing.
Yeah. I'm hearing you talk about all these records and videos, and you're going to this school, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, bluegrass and old time music, like actually being in the community, being in a jam circle, being at a festival and playing, to me seems like such an integral part. At what point did you actually like get yourself to a bluegrass or old time music event and kind of get yourself to like interact with this music?
Yeah, that's a really, I think back on that, and that's a really good question. I started going to a local jam when I was, I would say 20.
Okay.
So, and then I kind of got swept up in the Texas flat picking kind of competition. You know, it's almost like, yeah, a lot of
did
times I did not. Yeah. I got second place. I guess it was 2 years, in a row. And I learned a lot from doing that. In a lot of ways, it's like the musical equivalent of like a cucumber growing competition, where it's like you have, there's these like rigid boundaries of how you're supposed to arrange, which I think is actually really healthy, because it keeps, it kind of keeps people within a lane. And so that, it was helpful. But yeah, that kind of got me in the Texas festival world, and then just naturally started playing electric guitar for Texas songwriters. And that was kind of my foray into some sort of like musical community outside mm-hmm. of music school.
What was your song for the competitions?
Well, I was always, I kind of always tried to do the left of center ones, but I did Beaumont Rag. I mean, it was with a number of different modulations, and like Dill Pickle Rag and these sorts of things. But also I played Done Gone, and you know, more kind of Florida tuned down. Well, actually, no, I wasn't allowed to tune down low. You have to be in standard pitch or capo 2 or capo 1-2, something
wow.
like that.
Wow. I had no idea there were rigid rules about this stuff.
Yeah, I know. It's a whole world. It's a great, it's a cool world. I still know people in it, but yeah, I had to drop out of that. It's so stressful.
Is there a prize for second place?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was $500. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
and then when did you leave Texas?
I left Texas after, well, I graduated into the pandemic. So yeah. That was May of 21, I guess. Uh-huh. And then I moved to LA, and, so that was May of 21. And, yeah, that was that. And I'm now in Nashville and go back to LA frequently. But yeah, that 2021 was kind of the year that I left.
Yeah. God, that's not that long ago.
No, it's not. It's not that long ago.
You've been
ago.
Busy.
Thanks.
So what was the move to LA for? Did you have musician friends, or were you trying to broaden your horizons, or what brought that about?
I did have some friends out there. I was pretty modular because a lot of my work when the pandemic hit was teaching online. Mm-hmm. Well, that was my work fully, was teaching lessons online, which was a saving grace. And so I figured, you know, I knew I needed to move out of Texas for what I was trying to do. And the lineage of guitar players and just thinkers and people in LA has always captivated me. And people in LA that I really like, what I kind of associate with a kind of coastal ethic of song driven, harmonically aware players, people like my friend Harrison Whitford, or people like Blake Mills. They're vastly different players, but those were the sorts of people, and the fact that they were concentrated in one area, mm-hmm. you know, is kind of a pretty easy option for me in terms of choosing a musical community.
Yeah. And you wrote about Harrison for our new 52nd issue, which is coming out in just a week or two here.
Oh,
super
wow.
Grateful for that. How easy, how hard was it for you to find these sort of like great players in LA and connect with them? Did you know them already? Did you have an in?
Honestly, no, I didn't. I think that I will say platforms like yours, like Fretboard Journal, it creates these online conversations. Mm-hmm. I really do associate a lot of that with my ability to connect with these people, because there's at least some common ground. And of course, Instagram and all these platforms kind of confuse what it means to know somebody. It's like, yeah, sure, I know that person. but I was lucky enough to get connected with Mark Goldenberg mm-hmm. very early on, and he became a mentor and a friend and someone that I play shows with and play music with and learn from. And yeah, it was really, yeah, Mark helped me out a lot. And
what does a duo show with you and Mark look like? I could go a million different ways, which is why I'm asking.
Oh, it was fun. I mean I still look forward to doing more with him, but we would play some of his original music, which mm-hmm. he's recorded with Eric Sky. We did some jazz standards, but more in kind of a Ralph Towner kind of way, open string, kind of lush kinds of things. And then we would just improvise either just together in a key center or using his Tanpura drone that he'd bring. So that sort of thing.
Are you flat picking? Are you finger style? What are you doing?
I'm not flat picking in like, I may be using a pick, but it wouldn't be of that kind of language. I'm mostly finger style with him. And yeah, we would play some of my original tunes. The record that I'm working on, he played on. And so there was kind of some repertoire that we built that way.
Yeah. Wow, you're blowing my mind, because I didn't realize how fresh out of school you were.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate
and,
that.
And the reason we're talking is because you're about to do a second run of this monumental book that you've put out, Guitars Have Feelings Too. And I didn't realize that book came out in what, 2020?
Yeah, right at the beginning of 2021. So it was December of 2020.
Okay, so you've come out of the gate with one heck of an instruction book. I feel like I'm diminishing what it is by even saying that. I'm so impressed. I'm sort of speechless here. We'll get into the minutiae of the book and what it's all about and how it's different from a lot of guitar instruction books. But like, what was the original kernel of an idea when you're like, maybe this could be a book?
Well, you know, in a way, first off, thank you. I really appreciate that. And yeah, thinking about the book, I've had some time to reflect on it, and I'm further from it. And sometimes, yeah, so it's hard to kind of parse my original thought as to what I think of it now. However, I do remember after school, after, you know, music school during the day, I would go to one coffee shop mm-hmm. and I would just go there 3 to 5 times a week and just write for 2 hours. And my original goal was to write a treatise on flat picking. Basically, I was early college. Early undergrad, I was going up the East Coast doing runs with a folk trio I was playing with. And we ended up at Clifftop, the old time fiddlers festival. And yeah, I've been playing, you know, Texas composition, bluegrass, that sort of music. And I saw shared repertoire, but it baffled me that the flat pickers were kind of, I don't want to say relegated, but due to the etiquette of that music and the way it works, they were kind of playing off in the circles by themselves. And, you know, you can't contribute melodically on guitar. And it was kind of a naive undertaking. I was like, well, what is that political rift? Like, what happened? And why can't guitar carry forward dance music? Because really the difference between bluegrass and old time, Mike Seeger has a great quote that bluegrass is just a different way of playing old time music. And it's like, I cite the guitar as almost like a nexus point of that. And it almost has a lot to do with bluegrass becoming this music that's to be performed and not necessarily danced to. Though people do dance at bluegrass gigs, and that is dance-driven music, it's not a contra dance. And in the bluegrass tradition doesn't have square dances. So I was going to write a treatise to be like, okay, how does flat picking marry this missing component, which is dance? And so I started thinking, Norman Blake, you know, he's not a bluegrass flat picker. Why? And to me, to answer both of those questions required the same level of research. So then I started going back and transcribing his sources. And as where it started was supposed to be this treatise, it then became this musical survey of transcriptions. So then it started spiraling. And then as I transcribed one thing, it would pose a different question. And then I would transcribe another thing. And then I would there was no order whatsoever. I just did one foot in front of the other. And then every like month or two, I'd try to like put everything together. And there was like this natural order that was growing. So in a lot of ways, it almost just feels like a project that you would do as a child. It's like, there's something to prove. I don't know what it is, but I'm confronted with questions. So it's almost like a Kafka novel in that way too.
And just to be clear, what's the timeline? How many years ago was it when you first heard Norman Blake on that family vacation?
I was 15, and now I'm 22 or 21 when I started the book.
So in a radically short period of time, you not only fell in love with bluegrass and old time music and flat picking, but you were able to analyze it at this level that we're talking about right now, which is insane.
That's very kind of you. There was nothing else that I've done in my life early on that presented itself as you have to do this. And I felt like I was, you know, I wanted to, you know, eventually present this book to Norman as something like, look, here's something that I think it talks about your playing in a way that it deserves. And I think that really was the thing. The book's not about Norman, but it's basically trying to retrace and kind of spin together the elements of style that everyone kind of knows. So like, yeah, he has some Riley Puckett ideas. He has some other Maybelle Carter stuff. There's some Doc Watson in his eighth note language. But I wanted something tangible that kind of put those things together, because that was the conversation I was trying to continue forward in my own playing. So I wanted a document that just had that in order. So I'm like, okay, it's ordered. I'm going to step away from it now.
Wow. We're talking about this. If anybody's listening to this and thinking that this is like some super academic treatise, it's not. It's actually, the thing that I love about it is you could actually, you know, most guitar instruction books that you flip through, it's like a couple of paragraphs on, you know, pick holding technique or time or whatever. And then you get the tab. But this almost reads like a narrative where you could spend days reading this without a guitar anywhere near you and learn a lot. You're putting a context around everything.
I appreciate that. Yeah, that was my goal with some of that, where it was people could just engage with it, because it's not a I really didn't want it to be theory laden. I really just I don't resonate with those books, like books like The Advancing Guitarist. Mick Goodrick, I believe, is the name of the person who did that. And that book, you can jump in anywhere. It's not overwhelming. He gives you prompts, but he doesn't give you too much.
Yeah.
And so that was a big inspiration. And people like Adam Levy, just they write these educational materials that are, you know, enjoyable to engage with, whether or not you're thinking about it on a, you know, next time I touch my guitar, that's a good parameter to work within. Or I have my guitar and here's a musical example and I'm going to play it.
Yeah, it's more of you offer like prompts or icebreakers in terms of like, here's one way it's been done and sort of why. And you also, like you said about Riley Puckett, like you're going way back to like string band tradition guitarists and Maybelle Carter. It's not just here's how to play like Norman Blake. Because it's all part of the same ecosystem.
Yeah, I try to draw a line of like, this is where this stuff comes from. And Puckett is like a proto, not like, he is a proto flat picker. And that language, whether or not we decide to look at it, it's there. You know, we're going to consume it if we're learning Clarence White stuff or any contemporary player. Mm-hmm. It's all there. So why not just, you know, peel the bark off and just look at it. And, you know, even if we don't learn it note for note, this is how that was working in the mid-20s or early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this book you're doing a second printing. So are you taking pre-orders now? Is that how it works?
Right. Yeah. So the book sold out pretty quickly. Like probably within seven, eight, 9 months. And it's just, And I was moving around a little bit, so I didn't have time to do a second printing, but the second printing is the same information. There's a bit of a change aesthetically. Which feels like it's kind of in its final form. And then I've updated the format of the notation. So the fingering left and right, well, there's not really right hand fingerings, but the left hand fingerings are more precise and easy to read. So the second edition, I should be getting those in a week or two.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Great timing. You mentioned wanting to be able to present this book to Norman Blake. Did that actually happen?
I did. This was like rewind to 2021, early pandemic. Well, I guess this was, it was however we want to describe the pandemic, early, mid. Sometime in 2021, I found his number basically. And through a lot of sleuthing, I found his number and I saw it was registered in the early 80s. And I thought, if there's anybody who's not updated their phone number since 1983, it's Norman Blake. So working up the courage was its own thing. But when I thought to myself, I have to do this. And I thought, please God, let it be Nancy who answers the phone if someone answers the phone. And I called and Nancy answered the phone. And we had a great conversation and she was very disarming and very appreciative for the call. And I said, you know, I don't want to be a pain. There's this book, Riley Puckett, Bullet Point, Mother Maybelle Carter. I think you and Norman might get some joy from reading it. And could I send it? She said, okay, I sent it. Didn't get a call back, but I called again and Norman answered. I was flustered as all can be. And I was like, I sent you this book. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah, of course. That was a heavy duty project. You're like some jazz guitar player in Texas, right? I'm like, sure. Yeah, of course. I'm a jazz guitar player in Texas. And I said, if I'm ever in the neighborhood, could I come, you know, visit with you? And basically fast forward to 2022. Yeah, I got to go down there. Yeah, it was a large part of me moving to Nashville, just to be in that just the closeness and yeah, some other things. But basically, yeah, I got to see him engage with the book, play tunes, and yeah, there was one thing that he said in addition to heavy duty, which was a very meaningful thing. What was that he said that he hadn't. He felt as though no one had contextualized his playing like that. And he said that he was impressed that how I tied together Mother Maybelle in the melodic sense and Puckett in the rhythmic sense. And yeah, that was kind of it. I in my mind, I was like, that's what I set out to do. And here he was.
I picture you almost like a movie when you're trying to call like a first date. Like going over a script in your head of like what you're going to say if Norman answers or
Yeah,
Nancy.
that's right. That is 100% correct. Yeah. As bad and as awkward as you think it was, it certainly was. But they were very patient and very nice. But no, it actually wasn't awkward. And they were, and it was, yeah, it was very natural.
Incredible.
Thank you.
I should mention at the Fretboard Summit this August, you're coming out with Bob Minner, and you're doing. I don't know how much we can say at this point, but it's a pretty incredible workshop on the music of Norman Blake, and you know, getting to hear his music and some of his thoughts. And have you thought much about how this is all going to go down?
I have, yeah. I don't know how much I can say, but I'll say that Bob is bringing some great materials that really, they show kind of an intimate look at how Norman thinks about music and his relationship to music, which is I would just attend that as an earnest audience member. But yeah, we're going to play some music, and we have some instruments that have that were kind of in his orbit, and instruments that were not in his orbit but are kind of in that vein or ethic of playing weirdo guitars that are not the standard choices. But yeah, I've thought about it. Yeah, well, yeah, aside from Bob's materials that he's bringing and the tunes, we're just going to kind of talk about our time with him and kind of his singular approach to, choosing guitars, playing on records, and yeah, all sorts of stuff, and hopefully some questions too we can answer.
We've made it this far, and we've been talking about Norman Blake, and I shouldn't assume that everybody who tunes into this podcast understands why, you know, yesterday we put out a video of the guitar that was featured on the cover of Whiskey Before Breakfast, and it features Bob and three other incredible players, and it's already made the rounds on YouTube. But what is it about Norman's playing? You know, I think the average guitar enthusiast has heard of Tony Rice. They've heard of Doc Watson. You know, Norman Blake might be the next level down in terms of like, I don't even know where I'm going with this, but like, what is it about Norman's playing that makes these players in the know, like yourself, gravitate towards him?
Well, I think you said it very well about the tone. Let's say Tony Rice, for example, is kind of this superhero figure within flat picks guitar. And then people like Clarence White, if people know Clarence White, he was played electric guitar, developed the B bender, the Parsons B bender. For his playing in the Byrds, he played on a ton of sessions, and he had an equally developed voice on electric and acoustic. But Tony gets, I feel like, talked a lot more in the bluegrass world. Though Clarence came out of French Canada and developed that, there's kind of a readiness to kind of the virtuosity of flat picking or playing up the neck or these sorts of things or being harmonically clever. that make it easier to talk about certain players. Norman, for me, is an entirely self-contained player, not only in terms of his flat picking technique, he's also an incredible fingerstyle player, dobro player, mandolin player, later in his life, a banjo player, has written songs, has played on records, has done solo records, has done these incredibly meaningful, intimate collaborations, mm-hmm. has kind of pushed the boundaries of string band music. And has always had this interesting relationship with bluegrass music where he felt like, you know, his hair was too long or he was too much of a hippie to belong in the bluegrass camp. Though technique wise, that plotted him that way. I think what makes it so difficult to talk about Norman is he's a flat picker, and he's grouped in with these bluegrass players. But that is not only the tip of the iceberg, it makes it very difficult to talk about him. But with Norman, there's just so much to engage with, not just in terms of his solo career, but, you know, playing on a Bob Dylan, record, Joan Baez records, Chris Christopherson's touring band. He's done it all, in addition to being this, what I think of as a John Steinbeck or a Flannery O'Connor in the literary tradition of writing these songs that, well, a long-winded way of basically saying, if Norman plays a Carter Family song, it's as close to the source as the Carter Family, in my personal opinion. And I think of Norman as a true source, as much as a progressivist. So that's kind of my spiel on him. But he makes it pretty difficult to talk about. It's difficult to talk about him because he's a shapeshifter, really.
He is, and yet, you know, he's not in the public limelight, really. He's just living his life in Georgia in Rising Fawn, and we were able in the same issue with your piece. Bob did a piece on the collaboration he did with pre-war guitars, and we got some new photos of Norman Blake, which is super cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the other thing that I think guitarists in the know or guitar collectors in the know gravitates towards is Norman seemed to have this like impeccable taste in guitars. I mean, even the prop guitar on the cover of Whiskey Before Breakfast was like a guitar any other guitarist would give their left arm for, but I guess wasn't great enough to be on the record.
Right.
But he did always have this like incredible foresight to know what to play, and now people are coming around going like, oh man, Norman knew it all along.
Totally. Yeah, no, I mean, he was always searching for something that inspired him in a way that was not measured up against what other people were doing. And oddball guitars, small body guitars, guitars that people just don't know about, like an Almkrantz guitar with the earliest version of a bolt-on neck from the 1890s that he used to use a raised nut on, a Recording King Nick Lucas, you know, just like these really these crazy guitars that and just Nick Lucas's in general for his style of music. And that inspires his playing just as much as anything else. And for example, like being in Nashville and having access to some of these instruments, you play them, you pick up a guitar. Like, for example, like the other week, I was with a friend, Joseph Terrell, and he had an HG00 that was Norman's, and Norman converted it from Hawaiian to Spanish himself. And it's a neck that he shaped, and I'm thinking to myself, who else was doing that, and how do you have time to do that? If that's just, I mean, you have to do that constantly every day. His own setup work, and it goes on and on, but it's you're absolutely right. I mean, every corner of his career, there's always some interesting weird guitar.
We haven't heard what guitar you play aside from that Telecaster you mentioned a long time ago. what did you, when you went to go see Norman, what guitar did you bring?
Well, I brought a guitar that Yeah, it was a weirdo. I ended up, yeah, I don't have it anymore. I ended up trading it to Norman, but basically it was a Washburn, a roughly 1930, some people have said a 35 Washburn 5238. And the way that I understand 5238s, if you ordered it from Washburn in the mid 30s, they would either just like send you a 00 or a 00 without you really knowing. And this was one of the rare 00s with laminated Brazilian rosewood and like gold filigree on the top and like a massively wide neck and a really flat radius. And that was what I brought over there. And yeah, and but at the time I was just playing my old Martin 0018, which was like my regular, it's a mid 50s 0018. That was, but yeah, moving to this part of the world kind of ruined me in terms of being around such incredible instruments all the time.
Did you take this guitar to the Washburn knowing that he probably was going to geek out and want
Well,
it?
it was a childlike thing because and not to, I mean, this all kind of ties back, but on my road trip from Houston to LA, I kind of just sold all my belongings and put everything in my car, and I drove through Santa Fe to visit some friends. I visited Stagold Guitars there, and they had this 5238 Washburn, and I just played it, and I fell in love with it. Super responsive guitar. Weird that laminated Brazilian rosewood is just its own kind of thing. And I put some stuff on consignment, got the guitar, and somehow in my mind, I'm like, I wonder if Norman's ever played one of these. And the first thing he did when he saw it was he just started laughing because he thought it was so funny. Like, I've never seen it. Like, I've played a lot of things, but this is a weirdo, and I've not come across it. So we were kind of just going back and forth, like, yeah, maybe I'd want something like that. So eventually I traded over to him.
All right. Hopefully you got something great. You don't need to tell me what it is.
I did. Yeah, I did. And it was a very fair deal, but I still want that Washburn back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Well,
need to get it back
it's
eventually.
fun to think of him opening that case and playing that thing right now.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it totally is.
You have a record coming out at some point soon. I mean, you gave me a sneak peek at it, and you want to talk about that?
I'd love to.
I mean, it's pretty wild. I mean, there's all the foundational Norman Blake, flat picking stuff we've been talking about is there. Like, the playing is incredible, but tell us about it.
Yeah, so it was one of those things where yeah, playing sideman roles, that was something that is something that I enjoy doing. I love that role, but basically for whatever reason, I've just always recorded at home. I've always just recorded solo guitar music. And the tradition of American fingerstyle guitar music, like a Robbie Basho or a Jack Rose, Fahey leaning music, like Wyndham Hill kind of crowd. I love these pastoral, huge records that guitar sermon records, if you will. And I always wonder, like, okay, so if you have finger picks, you can cover so much real estate at once. You can play polyphonically in this readily available way. And being a flat picker in a solo context is almost masochistic because you're like tightrope walking. So I thought to myself, like, what would it be like to make a Wyndham Hill record? Not that I want it to sound like a Wyndham Hill record, but I'm using Wyndham Hill as kind of a catch-all. But how do I make some kind of guitar sermon record that's not texturally austere with flat picking? The majority of the record, I would say, is actually finger picking, as it turns out, but a lot of it kind of borders on sound collage and just creating scenes. Maybe in the same way a Dave Rawlings and Gillian Welch record creates scenes in miniature, almost like little like a toy boat builder. Like they have so few textures that it forces you into this arena of, you know, smallness, really, and you're attuned to more details and silence in that way. So that was the project. That's where it started. And so I just would make demos and then I would think, oh my God, this is the final version. And then those would become demos. And then that happened a million times until once I got to LA and I had access to producers and engineers that, or really engineers that I had looked up to and players, finally assembled a kind of a core group on it. And I'm really excited to, eventually announce that. But yeah, the players are people that I really look up to and are just basically my favorite musicians at the end of the day.
Maybe later this year, early next year, or sometime.
I hope so. Yeah. I really do. Yeah. I appreciate you asking about it. I'm hoping within the next year at least.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's going to blow people's minds. When you were trying to make this sort of, I forget how you described it, Windham Hill-ish, landscapey, atmospheric flat picking record, did you find yourself adjusting your flat picking technique or using a softer pick or trying to tweak those elements to make it feel more like those records?
I love that question. I did kind of a survey of my favorite records in terms of not what kind of guitar they used or, but like what, how did the texture sound? How did the air sound through the microphone? How were they getting the air to sound that way, basically? And I did experiment a lot with thinner picks. Like there's a distinct flat picking sound, which early Norman has, and the late Orange Starr, who was like a Maryland based flat picker. He always used these thin Dunlop picks, like the nylon, I guess. Yeah. These gray ones, this 0.73s. And I love that sound on a just driving a dreadnought solo. So there was that. A lot of miking techniques, but nothing highbrow, just really concerned with textures and trying to perfect how to treat my fingernails. Thanks to Mark Goldenberg, he led me down the rabbit hole of figuring out how to get my nails to sound good.
All right. Share a tip or two. Come on.
Yeah. So this is the Goldenberg said you need to get one. Well, I know you listeners can't see this, but this is a Revlon nail file. Okay. Walgreens. This Walgreens, a kind of a seven-sided buffer. Mm-hmm. Just taking it around. And one thing I learned from the great banjoist Adam Hurt is fingernail tips at 1 o'clock on the clock face. And that approximates the 30 degree pick angle that I evangelize in flat picking. So if I'm cutting my fingernails where there's just a slight point at 1 o'clock.
As if you're holding your hand straight up.
Yeah, if you're looking at the front of your nails at your eyes, it's at one, kind of pointing at 1 o'clock on my index, middle, and ring.
Okay.
And then shaped with the I guess it's not diamond encrusted, maybe it is, the Revlon file, and then doing the buffer thing. I have thin, kind of brittle nails, but doing the buffing, that makes it sound really robust. And yeah, that changed a lot. And so that was kind of... Yeah, that's kind of what I figured out for it. Just because every time I play fingerstyle, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to cut all my nails off because I'd rather just hear the flesh. But I needed to drive a band in some context on this record, so I needed some nails.
All right. I love how you took Mark's tip and then you added your own. It's got a little banjo hack in there. I love it.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
So who all are you playing with these days? I know you're kind of bouncing between Nashville and L.A.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I am kind of in the zone of working on writing, writing stuff for Fretboard Journal and working on a project, kind of another instructional book in a different register. So I haven't been playing with people that much the last few months. But I, yeah, I've just been writing new solo music, and yeah, kind of as I get established here. Yeah, I mean, I played with Jordan Tice recently, played a show with Jordan, and that was really fun. And but no songwriter gigs at the moment. I've just kind of been kind of busy with kind of being in the trenches, writing and teaching and all that kind of stuff.
Great. Are you still taking on students online?
I am. Yeah. I'm kind of like, yeah, I am. I'm getting closer to the kind of brink of what I can comfortably do, but I really do. I mean, a lot of people will just come for like, I want to meet once a month. Can you give me a bunch of stuff? But it's a great process meeting people, but yeah, I do have room and still taking on those, one-on-one students, but yeah, mainly writing and kind of enjoying that kind of quiet side of music making. Mainly when I play shows, it's under my own name these days.
And what does the guitar collection look like these days?
It's good. I need to stop. But basically, I have the Tele, which has had a million modifications, as a Tele should. Just an old Regal Dobro. I've got an F5 mandolin that I really like, and two Martin 00018s, a G, a gut string, which is a 53. That was my aunt's that she gave to me. It was in her, she bought it in San Francisco in 53, and I have a 54 that's only 100 serial numbers off of it. And
it's really cool.
It's the perfect kind of nylon steel combo. Gibson L Century, and I've got an old banjo. I've got an old Fairbanks banjo, and what else? Epiphone Olympic, 1935 Epiphone Olympic that I really like, and just one amp, just a Tweed Deluxe amp, and that's I'm
all
good.
You need. Yeah,
that's all I need. Yeah.
Well, Cameron, again, the book is called Guitars Have Feelings Too. Is it CameronKnoller.com? Where do people find this?
Yeah, CameronKnoller.com. Right. Shop tab.
Yeah, I'll include a link to it in the show notes. I highly, highly recommend it. It blew my mind. I've only known you for a little while, and I saw this book and was like, where did this come from? Because, I mean, you really could spend years, you know, just one page at a time kind of like deep diving into this. It's incredible.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate your time and having me on here. And letting me help out with the mag. It's been a total blast and really an honor. So, yeah, can't thank you.
For us, too. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
All right, that was my talk with Cameron Knoller. I hope you enjoy it. Again, the book is called Guitars Have Feelings, Too. I've got a link to it in the show notes. The future of guitar, folks, is bright. We've got young people like Cameron chasing after Norman Blake, deep diving into this music and what makes it tick. I feel good about the future of guitar and the Fretboard Journal and all things fretted. I hope you do too. Till next time.